Hi, this is Juice. Before I begin today's podcast, I just wanted to take a moment to talk about Christmas shopping. The day in question is right around the corner, and you have no doubt been putting off your Christmas shopping like me. What, you hedging your bets that your friends and loved ones will all be wiped out by the Mayan apocalypse, sparing you the need to buy them gifts? Well, that's fine and good, but if you wait until after December 21st and we all live, you're going to be hard-pressed for time to do some shopping. December 21st is like a Friday, too. So unless you have an Amazon Prime membership with unlimited two-day shipping, you're going to have to do something awful, like buy locally. Here's what I recommend. Fuck the Mayans. This year, you should buy everybody you know disaster preparedness kits. I'm talking wind-up flashlight, radio phone chargers, tub bladders for water storage, and canned goods out the ass. And as a guy who knew people who went through the derecho storms of this past summer and whose power was out for 8 whole hours due to Hurricane Sandy, I know from what I speak. Now, before you load up, I do advise you first click through the Amazon banner at librarycast.com. That'll take you right to Amazon, and then this podcast gets a percentage of your shopping sales at no cost to you. Hell, you should buy yourself a generator on Amazon. That'd be nice. Or you can just be like the goodly soul who purchased a Western Digital My Passport 1TB USB portable hard drive after clicking through. Or the other person who bought a DVD copy of the Brandon Lee film Laser Mission. Sure, that sucker only gets 2 out of 5 stars on Amazon, but it's got the late great Ernest Borgnine in it. What are you going to do? Not watch it? But if you're going to wait until after December 21st to hedge your Mayan bets, I guess I understand. Just look around the net for an Amazon Prime trial offer and sign up. Then you can 2-day ship like there's no tomorrow. It's great, unless of course you forget to turn it off in a month and get charged for the full year. Not that I did that or anything. Hey, did you know that Amazon Prime customers get a whole bunch of streaming movies and TV shows for free? And you can even watch them through your PlayStation? I have no reason to know that whatsoever, because I certainly didn't do something dumbass like forgetting to turn off my Prime trial. So, very simple. Click the Amazon banner at librarycast.com. Buy some shit at Amazon. I get a cut of that shit to support my shit. Now here's some shit to listen to. The end. Hi, my name's Juice. All right, not really. But for the purposes of this podcast, that's what I'm called. For 5 years, I wrote a blog called Tales from the Library. It was a chronicle of the nutty crap that happened and the Lynchian people I met as a small-town Appalachian library employee. This podcast is an adaptation of my favorite stories from that blog. This is Tales from the Library Cast. Dateline, Friday, November 10th, 2006. Outlook not good. Our patrons may occasionally have wits as dull as a sackful of Terrence Malick films, but our computers don't always help them out. Witness a recent incident. A patron called me over to one of our patron computers because she said she was having difficulty getting an email to send. I started to explain that we have no control whatsoever over whether or not her particular email service was working properly. Then I saw her screen and realized what she'd done. At some point in her internet experience that afternoon, she'd come across an email link on the web to which she wished to write. Only instead of copying the email address and then pasting it into the to blank of an email form within her email client's website, you know, Hotmail, Yahoo, Gmail, etc., she just clicked on the link itself, which brought up an Outlook Express email window with the address conveniently plugged into the address field. I think you know where I'm going here, but I'll explain for those of you who are slow of mind. Outlook is not a bad program, per se. However, the Outlook Express program installed on our patron computers is superfluous on a near-criminal level. The only reason we have it at all is because we can't get rid of it. It was installed by our computer techs as part of Microsoft Office, and it's a non-functional program because our Outlook is not hooked up to anything. It has no POP addresses installed, because that's the sort of thing people are supposed to have set up either at home or at work. Unfortunately, when patrons click on email links on websites, they will still get an Outlook Express window into which they are able to type out an email, just like they could at home or work. It will even let them attempt to send it, but because it's not hooked up to anything, that mail doesn't actually go anywhere, and usually pops up a window telling them they are shit out of luck on this front. They then come get us and get unrighteously angry that they've wasted their time on something futile. We then have to go back and teach them how to cut and paste their copy into a proper email form within their real email provider. Or, in worst case scenarios, we have to first teach them what an email provider is and how to acquire one. Half the time, though, something has gone amiss and their text has completely vanished, making them even more jolly to deal with. So, our Outlook conflict patron of the day showed me her Outlook email form and hit send, so I could see the little box that popped up, reading, "Not gonna happen, lady." I explained that the little box was correct. It was not going to happen. At least not that way. I was then about to show her how to cut and paste her text into a proper email form when, instead of listening to me, she clicked send again, and her mail vanished entirely. "Did it send?" she asked hopefully. "I doubt seriously that it has," I said. "But I spent half an hour typing that," she said. I told her that I was very sorry that she'd wasted her time, but as I'd just explained, our Outlook was in no way set up to send and receive emails, and therefore had not. She then said this wasn't fair. We shouldn't have a program that wouldn't send her email when she spent half an hour typing it. I told her that I agreed with her entirely, but that all of my attempts to remove Outlook from the computers had resulted in computers no longer working properly in a wild number of other ways, so I'd finally just restored the damn thing and left it for better minds to deal with. What I wanted to ask her, though, was how exactly it was that she thought she could just start typing an email in an email form that was not her own. How could she have expected that to work in the first place? Now, I can hear you responding to my unasked question already. The obvious answer is that she had no reason to think it wouldn't work because that's how her email program operates at home and or work. And normally, I might even agree with you on this point. However, this lady decided to demonstrate her internet unsavvy to me even further. As I stood there, the lady then told me that she had recently won a prize online. It was a laptop computer. However, before she could claim her prize, the prize website insisted that she first sign up for some magazine subscriptions and credit card offers and lots of other stuff. Then, and only then, would they send her the laptop. "Yes, sir," she said that. One of the oldest of the internet's unwise idea bear traps, and she had not only stepped in it willingly, but was now trying to pry the jaws apart so she could get her other foot in there too. At this point, I had to bite down on the inside of my cheek to keep from venting my frustration with her little pea internet newbie mind via a primal scream. Instead, I stopped her in mid-sentence and warned her, in no uncertain terms, that she should in no way be involved with sites like that because they are scams. Or, if they're not completely scams, you have to buy and or sign up for so much other expensive crap to get the big free prize that it will not be worth it in the long run. "Well, I've already done it," she said in a very offended tone, as though I should dare not cast aspersions upon her purchases. She then explained that the problem she was actually having was that after she signed up for all the crap and tried to go to the page where she was to finally be awarded her blessed laptop, that page would not load. "Probably because it was a scam," I said. "No, it wouldn't come up," she said. "It said I didn't have access to it." "Ma'am, we don't have any control over whether or not scam websites will load." "But it said that I didn't have access to it, but that an administrator could let me in." I paused. "Wait a second," I said. "This page didn't happen to say St. Bernard on it by any chance?" "Yes," she said. "Ah, that's just our filtering software. I don't know why it would block that page, but we do have a password that will let you in." "Oh, very good then," the lady said, and turned right back to her interneting. And this time, I let her. Dateline, Friday, September 24th, 2004. Oprah's Psychic Balls. About 2 years ago, a middle-aged lady came into the library seeking a book with Oprah's mailing address in it. We had no such book, but I offered to look on Oprah's website. Alas, I discovered that Oprah's snail mailbox is unlisted, but she's all about some email. I tried to explain this to my patron. "Are you sure?" she asked. "Yes, ma'am. I know it seems weird that there wouldn't be a mailing address, but if there is one, it's not listed here." The patron gave me a sad look that tugged at my heart. She stood there, clutching a stack of 8 notebook pages with the ragged, formerly spiral-bound edges still attached, on which she'd penned a near-illegible missive to Oprah. It wasn't a letter asking for a free session with Dr. Phil or anything like that. Instead, as she explained, it was a letter to Oprah requesting money for her sister's cancer treatments. "Oprah gives money to people all the time," the patron said. "Well, you could send it to her in an email, if you like. You would have to retype it, though," I said. Unfortunately, Oprah doesn't have an email address listed either. Instead, her site has a little plea to the crown form field, which turns into an email after you finish and hit send. This lady was going to have to type in her whole 8-page letter. I could smell tragedy on the winds before it even began. At the patron's request, I logged her onto one of our public computers, loaded up the email form page on Oprah's website, and showed her what to do. After about half an hour's worth of work, I went back to see how things were coming along. The lady had typed in nearly all of her letter, and seemed fairly proud of herself. She wasn't the fastest typist in the world, but she had made admirable progress. I told her to let me know when she finished, and I would come back and give it a proofread if she liked. I went back to the circ desk. After a minute or two, it occurred to me that I should really have suggested that the lady compose her note in Microsoft Word. She could have saved it to the desktop so that if anything went wrong, like, say, Oprah's form having a time limit or something, her letter would still be there to recover. I should have listened to my inner voice and gone back to paste that lady's letter into a Word file right then, for not 1 minute after I thought this, I heard a loud "Ah!" from the computer hall, followed by a very quiet and pitiful, "Oh, help!" I rushed back to the computers. Her screen showed the desktop and no Internet Explorer windows. Upon seeing me, she stood up and began ushering me into her seat, saying, "Here, here, you can fix this." I sat, but I knew it was useless. There were no program shutdown warning windows or anything to indicate what had happened. It looked like she'd just X'd out of the window. "I don't know what happened," she said. "I was just typing, and then it all disappeared."
"What were you typing exactly?" I asked.
"This right here. I was starting this sentence." She pointed to it in her notebook pages. The first word of the sentence began with a W. I knew instantly what had happened. She had tried to capitalize it by hitting Shift-W, but had mistakenly hit Control-W, the command for closing out the window. I then had to delicately break this news to her, that all her work had vanished into the ether, never to be seen by us or Oprah again. I was afraid she would start weeping, but the lady didn't. Instead, she decided she'd had enough of computers for that day and would attempt this at some future date. I suggested she bring and or buy a floppy disk from us in order to save her work and prevent this in the future. She numbly agreed it would be a good idea and departed. Dateline, Monday, May 24th, 2004. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy. Ours is not a library where patrons spend a lot of time asking us for office supplies. Their most frequent request is for a pencil and scratch paper. Sometimes they ask to borrow a stapler. Today, though, we had a man I've dubbed Cranky Liquid Paper Guy, who wanted us to be f***ing Office Max. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy was not only unhappy that he didn't have his own jar of liquid paper to use, but was also cheesed off because he was under the gun of some kind of filing deadline. He had what appeared to be at least 2 rush job projects which he had to accomplish before the day was out. Among these were several truly bad photocopies of the forms he needed to file, which he'd brought with him. He was interested in further tarnishing these by reproducing them on our devil copier. And while the devil copier was at least in operational condition following its recent gut rebuild, it had completely given up on the notion of precision toner adjustment. If the original document was bad to start with, there was just gonna be no helping it.
Cranky Liquid Paper Guy learned this, but not before demanding liquid paper from us, with which he planned to white out the information already filled out on the forms so that he could use them for himself. I loaned him our liquid paper pen, and he started a correctin'. Along for the ride was Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy, who didn't much seem to want to be there at all. She mostly stood around looking sullen and occasionally interrogating me about our patron computers. "What did you have to do to use one?" she asked. "Did the computers have internet access?" she asked. "Did you have to have a library card first?" she asked. "Did you have to pay?" she asked. I answered her questions, but she seemed suspicious and didn't sign up. Meanwhile, Cranky Liquid Paper Guy began complaining about the quality of our liquid paper pen. What he really wanted was a traditional bottle of liquid paper. "Did we have one?" he asked. I told him that we did not. This didn't set well with Cranky Liquid Paper Guy, but he was somehow able to get over it. At one point, I thought he was finished with the liquid paper, since he had returned it to me and went back to making copies. Oh no! He came back to borrow it several more times. Soon, he also needed scissors and scotch tape and the liquid paper again. I finally just left all of our office supplies on the desk so that he could use them at will. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy suggested to his wife that she should use a computer to type up what he called the resume. I wondered if he meant typing up the resume as opposed to piecing it together from worse photocopies of bad originals. She didn't seem too keen on it either way. Mr. and Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy finally paid for their photocopies and left, but threatened to come back later. Around 3 o'clock, the Cranky Liquid Paper couple made good on their threat and did indeed return. This time, Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy did want to use a computer to work on the resume, after all. Unfortunately, the computers were all still full, and there were two people waiting ahead of Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy. "Oh, we didn't realize they'd be full, or we could have reserved one earlier," Cranky Liquid Paper Guy said. "Actually, we don't reserve computers here. It's all first-come, first-served," I told them. "Oh, well, where we used to live, you could reserve them," he said, in a tone that suggested we were somehow lagging behind in our service if we didn't offer such a plan. "Yeah, I've heard of that," I told him. After 20 minutes, I was finally able to bump enough users to give everyone, including Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy, a computer. After a bit, Cranky Liquid Paper Guy asked, "Do you have a typewriter for public use?" "Well, I can't remember any patrons ever using it, but we do have one. We only use it to type up library cards and spine labels, but if you need to use it, it's okay by me," I said. "Actually, if you need to type something up, I'd really recommend you use a computer instead," I told him. "Can't," he said. "The information on these forms is wrong, and I have to correct it. I can't do that in a computer unless you have something to scan it with." "Technically, we do own a scanner. It's upstairs in the locked staff bathroom until such a time as we have available desk space somewhere in which we can install it. I hear some is scheduled to open up in about a year and a half." "Nope," I said. "Don't have one of those." At his request, I showed Cranky Liquid Paper Guy how to insert paper into the typewriter and how to line up the form lines with the guidelines on the typewriter head so that he could type on them. Most importantly, though, I showed him where the correction ribbon button was. As expected, Cranky Liquid Paper Guy was not a champion typist, so the half hour that followed went exactly like this. Aw, damn it! Damn! About 5 minutes into this show, I offered to come over and do it for him, just so I wouldn't have to listen to that for the length of time I knew it would take him. Nope, he said he had it under control. Fine. At around 4:20, Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy was still on the computer. At 4:22, two new patrons arrived, and I put them on the two free computers. If anyone else came in for a computer, it would be Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy who would have to get off. At 4:26, the door opened, and the familiar robot drone of, "May I please sign up to use a computer?" hit my ears. Parka! I went back and told Mrs. Cranky Liquid Paper Guy she was out of time. She'd been on the computer for well over half an hour at this point. Do you think she'd done jack shit toward writing a resume? Oh, hell no. hadn't even cracked a word processor. If she had, I might have even had justification for denying Parka a computer in favor of giving her more time for something useful, but she was just surfing the net. When I told her she was out of time, she looked distraught. She then went and whispered to Cranky Liquid Paper Guy for a bit. Rather than complain about the deadlines and pressure, as I expected they would, Cranky Liquid Paper Guy instead asked if it would be okay for them to type up her resume on the typewriter. Frankly, I think I would have preferred hearing complaints, because typewriter was the last word I wanted to hear in association with patrons and resumes. His typewriter plan was never going to work. A decent resume, after all, is not something you can just throw together on a typewriter in less than half an hour, particularly when you're a guy who could probably type better with his ass cheeks than his hands. But what could I do? Tell him no? Oh, I meant to indent that. Oh, damn it. It was maddening. In a fit of service-oriented mental self-preservation, I went to the card catalog computer and loaded Microsoft Word. This is not a computer we let patrons word process on, ever. But damn it, if it would get these people out of there faster and prevent the huge scene of despair and teeth gnashing I foresaw going down at closing time, I was letting them do it. No, that's okay, Cranky Liquid Paper Guy said after I'd offered him the computer. We've already started over here. Fine, do it the hard way if you must, but you'll get no sympathy from me come 5 p.m., I did not say aloud. A few more pecks and deletes into the process must have turned on a light bulb in his head, 'cause they gave up on the typewriter and restarted on the computer. This time, it only took about 10 minutes of typing for Cranky Liquid Paper Guy to figure out that this, too, was a hopeless cause. They thanked me for my time and my help, paid us for the copies, and left sans the resume. And, thankfully, sans the big nasty parting scene I had been expecting. Dateline, Thursday, November 15th, 2007. A visit from the family. There's this good friend of mine whom I've known since the 8th grade. Let's call him Matthew, 'cause that's his name. Now, I don't know for sure what Matthew eats today, but after moving out on his own during college, he traditionally avoided raw vegetables like they were made of poison. I've had several occasions to share a meal with Matthew since then, usually in such fine dining establishments as, say, a Ryan's Buffet. When at such buffets, my first course of the evening is always to visit the never-ending salad bar for a goodly sized plate of greenery. This, in my mind, is to help offset all the brown food I'm about to chow down on. For Matthew, however, salad doesn't even factor into his world. It's not that salad was considered and then decided against in favor of tastier fried grub. No, no. Instead, salad as a concept was never on Matthew's radar to begin with. And upon sitting down with our first courses before us, Matthew has always given my choice of greenery a most bewildered look. It's an expression that clearly states, "Dude, we're adults now and our parents are not here. We don't have to eat that shit anymore." Never mind the fact that I always finish my salad and then put away twice as much fried crap as Matthew does. And never mind the fact that with every trip to the bar, we were both secretly stuffing packets of crackers into our pockets so that we could have a great big juvenile cracker crumb spitting fight in the parking lot afterward, returning ever so briefly to those blessed post-cafeteria 8th grade big cracker crumb spitting fights of yore. Never mind all that, he was still offended to his soul that I would eat lettuce willingly. Some folks are like that with libraries. Actually, Matthew is like that with libraries, but that's because he's dyslexic and hates reading, hence why I feel completely safe in talking bad about him here. For some folks, the very concept of a library has never once popped up on their radar, and if they enter one at all, it's due to one of three reasons. A, because they have mistaken it for the water department, which probably only happens around here since the water department is indeed next door. B,
There's something that we have that they need, and for free. Or C, because the evil cabal known only as they sent these folks to our door. These library neophytes are easy to spot, too. There's just a certain air about them of library inexperience that permeates their being, their very body language, and causes them to stand out in a bad way, kind of like tag body spray. A whole family of such anomalies visited the library a couple of weeks back, determined to use them a computer. Actually, only two of the anomalies, the grandmother and the older brother, wanted to use them a computer, which they had been told, perhaps even by they, that they could use to apply online for a job with a local chain grocery store. The other two family members, a 10-year-old younger brother and his adult, mentally handicapped cousin, were left to wander the building. I observed them for a while, much as a primatologist might observe the behavior of a couple of orang-utans in laboratory conditions. They seemed wildly out of place, yet still fascinated by the sheer volume of books we had on display. After exploring for a while, the little brother came up to the circ desk. "Do you have any books on dinosaurs?" he asked. "Oh, do we have books on dinosaurs," I said, grinning. "Let me show you where they are." I led him over to the expansive 567s, which he seemed quite impressed by. He immediately set about pulling books out, giving them a gander, and then woefully misshelving them. I left him to it. After about 5 minutes, during which I had to help Grandma and older brother with their job application website, which was admittedly a little wonky itself, little brother came back to the desk. "How much do these books cost?" he asked. I told him that they were free to borrow, but he would need a library card. "How much does a library card cost?" he asked. It, too, I noted, was free. The kid's face lit up, and he quickly dashed to his grandmother, card application in hand, to see if she would let him have one. She filled it out and sent him back, and, after confirming with our computer that he didn't already have one, a suspicion I was pretty sure would not be the case, I soon had a shiny new card to pass to him. Off he went to find more books, but soon was back at the desk. "Do you have any books about pirates?" he asked. Actually, pirate books were a bit thin on the ground, outside of fiction, so I showed him some age-appropriate storybooks featuring pirates. He'd barely touched them when he decided he'd rather have books on dragons. They, too, were kind of scarce, and most of the fictional books we had on them were aimed at either far smaller children or far older adults. I was trying to find a happy medium when the mentally handicapped cousin interrupted to ask for books on outer space and telescopes. These were easier to find. I took him to them, then had to turn back to the dragons, 'cause the kid was getting insistent. I finally settled on the Del Toro Quest series, which I thought might not have as many pictures as he would like, but he didn't seem to care, and took most of what we had of the series. He checked them out, along with a dinosaur book or two, but soon returned to trade out books for other books that he wanted more. Before I knew it, the kid and the cousin were running me ragged throughout the entire building in search of books on wildly different subjects. Their glee at each discovery was so powerful, though, that I could hardly be annoyed. "Do you have any zombie books?" the kid eventually asked. He then gestured back toward the computers. "They're for my brother." The brother looked to be at least 16, so I fetched World War Z and told him it was possibly the best zombie book we had on hand, and possibly the only one we had on hand unless you count I Am Legend. Brother and grandmother eventually finished up their work application, and then, at the kid's insistence, the brother came to get a card to check out his zombie goodness. No sooner had I made the card, though, than the two siblings began a vicious argument as to which of them would actually get to check out the book. The little brother, perhaps out of some sense of gift-giving or courtesy, wanted to check it out on his card, while the older brother rightfully wanted it on his own. I finally broke it up, saying that it was the older brother's book, so it was going on the older brother's card, and they both seemed fine with that. What I was then dubious about was whether or not we would ever see any of these books again, since library neophytes are very often oblivious to such requirements. However, the cousin has since returned his books, and as of today, I spied World War Z back on the shelf. Who knows? Maybe I've turned this family to the light. The commentary bit. Today's podcast celebrates neophytes of the world who once visited our library. Be they computer neophytes, word processing neophytes, office supply neophytes, or merely library neophytes in general. This actually is one of the scripts that I had prepared many months ago, but it's been in my in-progress directory because I kept somehow assuming from the title of the file that it was actually the script for Season 1, Episode 5, The Ballad of I.N. Fight. You might remember that episode because it featured a lady who took well over half an hour to sign up for a Hotmail account because she stubbornly refused to listen to my advice about not using her own name or her dog's name as her password, and then whose password I had to remember for her when she came back some months later and had forgotten it once again. I was going to link to that episode at librarycast.com, but frankly, it's almost less effort to just re-release it as a bonus this week. Go listen to it. It's funny. Fortunately, I finally opened the file and noticed that all these stories were in there that I'd not yet recorded, so that was providence. I have to admit that my behavior, as evidenced in some of the entries today, is not especially good. I mean, for the first story, I basically allowed that lady to go ahead and put both of her feet in the shitty internet scam bear trap, but she can't say I did so without first warning her multiple times not to do it. She was determined to believe that the scam she'd gotten involved with was not a scam, and she was going to get that free laptop even if it meant signing up for $800 worth of hassle-intensive offers to do so. When I originally wrote the entry for the blog, I was at a point where I had already had to deal with self-destructive behavior from patrons like Barbara Turd Merkel so often that it became my basic policy to simply warn people about the mistake they were about to make once, but if they insisted on forging ahead, they were adults and could learn their own life lessons. In other words, fuck 'em. My crack about Terrence Malick films being dull at the top of the show was due to my having seen his film The New World not long before writing that entry. If you've not seen it, I don't recommend it. But it's basically the story of Pocahontas and John Smith, told in the most aggressively boring way Malick could manage. It's beautifully shot, very well acted, I'll grant you. But holy shit, is that a boring-ass movie! I've had more engaging conversations about history with Gene the genealogy machine. The Oprah's Psychic Balls entry actually had a bit of an odd history behind it that was full of cosmic coincidence and possible psychic activity. The reason it's called Oprah's Psychic Balls is because when I sat down at my computer to pen that entry about the encounter I had had with an Oprah address-seeking lady, I first decided to go and read a few of the latest blog entries of my library blogging cohorts. And the first one I went to was the now-defunct blog I Have a Snake, written by Daisy Porter, who, you might remember, is a former coworker of my buddy Glenn from Season 1, Episode 16. Imagine my shock and amazement when Daisy's entry for that day reported a similar experience with an Oprah address-seeking patron. In Daisy's version, the patron was seeking Oprah's address so that she could write her a letter to ask for help finding a therapist. When told that she could only send Oprah an email, the lady became quite distraught and kept saying, "What I'm gonna do? What I'm gonna do?" Daisy, being a much more service-oriented library employee than I ever was, helpfully suggested to the patron that she could find a therapist via the local Yellow Pages, to which the patron said, "No, no, I'm not gonna do that. What I'm gonna do, what I'm gonna do." There's a bit more to the story than that, of course, and it's all pretty funny. I Have a Snake is unfortunately no more, but you can read Daisy's tale for yourself at the original Tales from the Library blog, because Daisy gave me permission to reprint it there a few years back. I have it linked handily, though, at librarycast.com. You can also find a link to Daisy's current blog, Queer YA. The story of the library neophytes is a favorite story from the latter days of my blogging career. I really enjoyed introducing that kid and his cousin to how libraries worked and seeing their joy at the discovery. That was awesome. I really hope they remain patrons to this day. Speaking of blogging careers, while I have found time to put out new episodes of Tales from the Library Cast each and every week for the past year and a half, I've not had so much luck for the past several months with my sequel blog, Borderland Tales. This is because I'm still in an ongoing war with Suddenlink over whether or not they're going to give me internet at my house here in Tri-Metro. Well, I suspect that this coming week may bring some more activity on the Borderland Tales front, and some long-awaited updates to that particular storyline. Fingers crossed, I should be getting high-speed internet very soon. But if you happen to be one of the Suddenlink employees who read the blog entries about my battles with Suddenlink and getting them to call me the fuck back, and you came to my aid, let me just say thank you very much for the belated help, but I am afraid to report that the story may not end well for you guys. So keep your eyes peeled for that at borderlandtales.blogspot.com. No podcast recommendation this week other than one for last week's episode of this podcast. While listening to it after it had been posted, I noticed a couple of glaring flaws and a couple of missed opportunities. So I did a re-edit of the whole thing designed to correct my errors and add some audio effects that I thought might spruce it up a bit. So if you heard the version I posted last Sunday, you might give the new version a listen. It's actually the only version available online now, but if your phone automatically downloaded it last week, you might have the old version. If you happen to have downloaded it late in the week and you can hear birds in the background for most of it, then you already have the new version. Follow me on Twitter at LibraryCast. Read the original tales from the library blog at library.blogspot.com. Music for the show is by Mr. Joel Hunger. Until next time, just remember, the library loves you, but only if you can type better with your fingers than you can with your ass. Line, nothing but deadline. I love those deadlines, my kind of show.